Last summer, on our trip to Europe, we took our families to Dachau for a visit. Dachau is the Nazi prison camp outside of Munich, and it is truly a somber place to visit. We wanted our children to experience this, along with all the wonderful things we did on our trip. So together we walked the halls of the now rather pristine prison wards, learned how suffering and death were carried out with great precision. That whole prison camp is laid out so precisely and perfectly. It's a place of death and suffering. It's hard to believe sometimes. Silently we stood before the memorials and thought of the evil that lurks in the minds of men. There are thousands of people who go through this memorial and this former prison camp, and yet it's so quiet as you walk through these halls. Everyone walks quietly and thinks. I was particularly moved that day as we stood in front of the prison cell of Pastor Martin Niemöller, one of the members of the German resistance movement. Next to him, next to his cell, or nearby, I can't remember if it was the very next cell, but very close by, is a cell that was set up with a temporary little pulpit made out of a suitcase that he used, and others when called to comfort those who were dying in the prison or suffering or needing hope. Martin Niemöller survived the prison camp. He was liberated from the camp by the Allies. He went on to live a long life of service for the Lord. He actually died in 1984. And it was Martin Niemöller who made the famous quote after the war. In Germany, they came first for the communists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, and by that time, there was nobody left to speak up. Albert Einstein once said, "The world is too dangerous to live in, not because of people who do evil, but because of people who sit and let it happen." In Judges chapter 4, where we pick up our study this morning, we learn about evil and God's response to evil. God saves in surprising ways in this chapter. God deals justly with evil in this world by using men and women of faith to take a stand against evil in their culture, in their world, in their society, to take a stand against injustice. He uses men like Martin Niemöller during the Nazi Holocaust and Deborah in the time of the Judges. In fact, God uses two women in this passage to administer justice to powerful evil warlords in the land of Canaan. But the story doesn't begin with the evil of the warlords. The story begins with the evil of Israel, God's people. Evil lurks in the hearts of God's people just as much as it lives in the minds of the people of this world. God doesn't just deal with the evil of the world. He deals first with the evil in the church. And the first principle this morning is that common sin reaps nasty consequences. Look at verse 1 of chapter 4. "Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died." Do you notice that word again? Again did evil after Ehud died. Ehud, we studied last Sunday, marvelously delivered the nation of Israel from the oppression of the Moabites. The story thrilled the Israelites. They loved to tell this story for years, but as soon as Ehud died, they went right back to the ways of evil they had practiced before. It is important to understand that salvation does not consist of tear-filled testimonies and emotional stories of deliverance. Real salvation is all about changed lives, about staying away from evil. If all we do is have a great testimony time and tell stories of how God delivered us from the evil we have done, but we never change, then we do not understand salvation. We will turn right back into the evil we once knew as soon as the policeman is out of sight. In this case, Ehud dies. Well, that's what Israel did. So God sent some nasty consequences to show them that you don't get away with evil. Verse 2 tells us that the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. Hazor was the largest Canaanite city in the land of Palestine, located 9 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. Joshua had already soundly defeated the city of Hazor. He had burned the city. But the city rebounded under the leadership of a powerful king named Jabin, who developed a coalition of smaller generals to control the north country. The general, the main general of his army, was a man named Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim, which means Harosheth of the Gentiles, of the nations. Most scholars believe that this city was located across the country near Mount Carmel, where the famous Valley of Esdraelon, the Valley of Megiddo or Armageddon, goes by various names, Valley of Jezreel, narrows as it nears the coastline. This particular view of the Valley of Esdraelon overlooks the Kishon River, near where Sisera's home is believed to have been located, his city. The Kishon River, that narrow little thread of green winding its way through the valley, will become God's weapon of choice in the defeat of evil. This map helps us understand the places in this story. The Valley of Armageddon is once again central to the story of God's salvation. It was in this valley that Sisera oppressed the people with his power for 20 years. There are actually two accounts of this story, the one we look at today in chapter 4 and the one we look at next week in chapter 5. In chapter 5, we learn something of the evil of Sisera. Here we learn of his power. He had 900 chariots in his army. Flat land in the valley was particularly useful for chariot armies, chariot warfare. The chariots were essentially the tanks of World War I, the bombers of World War II, the missiles of today. They were the epitome of the highest form of technology in warfare in that time period, and the Israelites had no chance against the chariots of Sisera. For 20 long years, they were oppressed by Sisera. They were oppressed, they were starving, they were suffering, tormented under this man, and he and his people enjoyed wealth and prosperity while they lived in poverty. Who did it to them? God. Do you notice who sold them to Sisera? God did. God sold his own people to Jabin and to Sisera as a consequence for their sin. And God is still in charge today. And he could do the same with America or any nation. For there are consequences when people pursue evil, even consequences for God's own people. Common sin reaps nasty consequences. Second principle this morning, God uses whom he chooses. Verse 4. Now Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. And she used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. We don't know who Lapidoth was, except that he's the husband of Deborah. Anybody hear of Lapidoth before? But we sure know a lot about Deborah. God was using her as a judge in Israel during these days. She lived in the south country of Israel, and men and women came to her for advice, legal decisions. She lived somewhere between the villages of Ramah and Bethel. In this picture here, she was a leader, she was a prophetess. She spoke for God to a people seeking a word from God. She was a political leader, a religious leader in that day. And I personally think that Deborah was the greatest of all of the judges until Samuel comes along, and he's the last of the judges. God uses whom He chooses. Here's a woman being used of God in a day when it was a man's world and a man's culture. And yet God chooses to use Deborah. And folks, we had best be careful when we try to put God in a box and tell Him He can't use certain people to do His work. God uses whom He chooses. And He chooses here to use a woman named Deborah. Verse 6. Now she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Ahinoam, from Kedesh Naphtali, and said to him, "Behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded you to go and march to Mount Tabor, and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali, from the sons of Zebulun, and I will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his many troops to the river Kishon, and I will give him into your hand." Barak was a general who lived in the north country near Jabin of Hazor. He was quite familiar with the enemy. Deborah summons him to her place 50 miles to the south, tells him that God has chosen him to lead the nation against Jabin and Sisera. He is to march to Mount Tabor, call 10,000 men to war from the tribes in that area, and she tells him that God will draw out, and the word is like, word means to lure. God will lure Sisera's army and give him, sell him. There's that concept again. Just like He sold Israel into their hands, God will sell Sisera into Barak's hands. So if Barak does his part, God will lure the enemy into the trap and defeat them. Look at verse 8. Then Barak said to her, "If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me," speaking to Deborah, "I will not go." And she said, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take. For the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman." Then Deborah rose and went with Barak to Kedesh, and Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali, went up to Kedesh, and 10,000 men went up with him. Deborah also went up with him. Now, many have criticized poor Barak for a lack of faith here, and perhaps there's an element of that. I can't be certain. But I think that Barak could very simply be a man who humbly acknowledged his need for God's guidance and respected the fact that Deborah was God's chosen person to deliver that guidance, and wanted her with him as he went into battle. Deborah willingly joins the battle. She doesn't rebuke him in any way. The only thing she does say is that the honor won't go to you. But of course, that's a principle that we all ought to remember, for in any battle, the honor doesn't go to us. But then she says something interesting. She says, "God will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." God uses whom He chooses to do His work. Again, in a culture that is male-oriented, God chooses to use women to do His great work in this battle. "God has always led me of Himself," Florence Nightingale wrote in 1851. She knew that she was taking an unpopular stand in her day as a woman. She would break from her family, she would break from her society and culture to argue for the reformation of health care in our country, and in fact started that process. But she said, "The first idea I can recollect when I was a child was a desire to nurse the sick. My daydreams were all of hospitals, and I visited them as often as I could. I never communicated with anyone. Why? It would have been laughed at. It would have been laughed at." Once again, during the 1800s, when England was using children in their sweat houses for virtual slave labor, it was a man named Lord Ashley who stood up to the abuse of children in that day. One of his enemies said, "The name of Lord Ashley would forever stink in the nostrils of men." He was hated by his culture. He was hated by those in London who were important and powerful because he stood for the poor. He tried to help the children who were virtual slave labor in those sweat houses, in those factories. When you're doing good, you will often be vilified. So be very careful about living for the popularity of men. It is no sure sign of living for God at all. And God's applause is what really counts. When the man known as the Poor Man's Earl died in 1855, the streets of London were packed with thousands of poor people whom he had helped with the reforms of the evil going on in the factories of the city. One group of schoolboys marched down the street with a banner which read, "I was a stranger and you took me in." God uses whom he chooses to get done what he wants done. And is God choosing you? And how is he choosing you? What difference does he want you to make, man, woman, or child in this world? Don't be afraid to stand against culture. Don't be afraid to be different. Don't be afraid to stand against the injustices that take place in our world and in our country. For God, Christians have a long history of doing just that. Now look at the third principle. Trivial details display God's power. This story is filled with some key details that ordinarily we would consider to be rather trivial, rather coincidental. But there are no coincidences where God is concerned. God specializes in the providence of coincidence. The first detail is found in verse 11. Sort of dropped into this whole passage is verse 11. "Now Heber the Kenite had separated himself from the Kenites, from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak in Za'anim, which is near Kadesh." Now what in the world does that have to do with the story? It seems totally out of place. Yet it is one of the crucial elements of God's providence that leads to salvation. Who is Heber the Kenite and what does he have to do with God's salvation? Well, we learn later that he is the husband of Jael. That's what makes him important. And the Kenites were not Israelites. Moses married into the family during his days in the wilderness, and they joined the Israelites living in the southern region of the country down by the Dead Sea. All of his relatives lived down there, but Heber migrated north for some unexplained reason and has been living near Barak for some time now. You see, God took this man from his home, from his family. He's a businessman, and he moves him all the way northward. And we're not given the reasons, but he places this family in the exact location that he needs him to be when years later his wife will be the one to deliver the nation from the hand of Sisera. Does God do those sorts of things? Yes. Yes, he does. God moves people around in order to accomplish his will. And we may not understand why God led us to choose this school, or God moved us to this town, or we became a part of this church, or this place over here, or this neighborhood, or this. We may not understand immediately why God moves us around, or why He takes us and makes the changes in our lives that He makes. But know this, God's providence is seen in coincidences. He is the master of all of those details, and He uses us exactly where He places us. And it's only years later that we look back and we see the design in God's movements of our lives. All right, the scene is now set. The players are in place. Barak gathered his army on Mount Tabor. Across the Jezreel Valley, the word comes to Sisera that the Israelites have gathered an army, so he goes out with all his chariots to destroy them. The valley, as you can see, is flat, level. It's the perfect place to use a chariot army. The Israelites don't stand a chance against such an army in the wide, flat plain of Jezreel. So here's the second trivial fact that God uses in this story. The time of the year must have been the dry season after the spring rains have gone by. For Sisera would not take his chariots out into this plain during the wet season. It would have been too hard to maneuver. The dry season was the perfect time for Sisera. The plain was the perfect place. Now you remember what God said. He said, if you do your part, Barak, and gather on Mount Tabor, I will do my part and I will lure him. What's the lure? The lure is, it's the dry season. It's a flat plain. These Israelites don't stand a chance. That's Sisera's thinking. So he gathers his army. He hardly knows it yet, but God's just lured him into a trap. For God is the master of seasons. God is the sovereign of geography. God is the ruler of psychology. God's in charge. Mount Tabor is a cone-shaped mountain at one end of the valley. Deborah looks out at the enemy gathered in the plain below. Remember now there's, you picture 10,000 soldiers up on the slopes of Mount Tabor waiting for battle. Deborah looks across the valley at the chariot army gathered below in the plain. And she says, Barak, it's time for you to take your army and charge down these slopes, a frontal assault on that chariot army down there. And Barak, the general, can you imagine what goes through his mind? You're nuts. You're absolutely crazy. You're a woman. You don't know about military strategy. Why am I going to take 10,000 men on foot and charge down the mountainside at chariots on the plain below? But Barak doesn't say any of those things if he thought them. He says, okay. And he follows exactly what Deborah tells him to do. And the soldiers come streaming down that mountainside into the plain. And we're told that the Lord routed the enemy before them. And the word routed means to send them into confusion. And they turned and they drove their chariots the other way from the oncoming foot soldiers and back toward the city across the valley. What happened? Well, the text doesn't tell us in chapter 4. But chapter 5, verse 21 gives us a hint. Look at chapter 5, verse 21. Verse 20, the stars fought from heaven, from their courses they fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon, O my soul, march on with strength. Well, there's the torrent of Kishon. It's a little muddy brook in the dry season. But in the rainy season, it floods across that low plain. And the plain has a lot of clay in it, and it becomes very, very slippery. And you can't operate horses and chariots on that slippery terrain. And one of the Hebrew words that's used to describe this whole event is a word that refers to God working through thunderstorms and rain. This is a huge torrential downpour that God sends. Barak didn't know it until they charged down the mountain. But as the rains come, the plain turns into a slippery field. And the chariots can't maneuver, and they decide to retreat and get out of there to fight another day. Now, the third trivial fact of the battle. The Kishon River swells quickly from the rain, caused the major problems because their city is on the other side of this brook. They're trapped by this little brook. They have to get across the river to get home. And on the far end of the valley of Jezreel is a narrow pass where the river goes through on its way to the ocean. And so we have the fourth trivial fact. Across that pass in the hill country is their home, their city. But as they near this pass with the foot soldiers coming at them from behind, it becomes impossible to get the horses and chariots through this crowded pass as they slip and slide in the muck and the mire, and the river is overflowing as it rushes into this little narrow pass, and they can't get across. They abandon their chariots, they start running. Text says that the Israelites catch up to them and kill them all in the valley as they try to get back to their city. Sisera, the general, does a rather odd thing at this point. He does get out of his chariot and he begins to run away, but the scriptures indicate that he ran away on foot, but he went in the northeast direction, the opposite direction from his own city. Why? Well, trivial fact number five. Sisera decides that he can reach Hatzor and Jabin the king if he cuts northeast across country through the valleys. He'll make it to Jabin the king. Where no one else would expect him to go, he'd be safe. See, God is the master of trivia. He even knows Sisera's plan, and he went all by himself. There's nobody else with him. He took off on his own. But God knows, and he's walking right into the trap. But before we look at the trap being sprung by God, there's one more important element. The god of Hatzor was Baal, who lived, according to their theology, on Mount Hermon farther to the north. Now Baal, their god, is supposed to be the god of thunderstorms and rain and wind. Well, who's really in charge of the thunderstorms and the rain and the wind? Jehovah! He just bested Baal at his own game. This is a polemic and apologetic against the gods of their own culture. Who wins? Our God wins. Despite 20 years of your power and your oppression. Fourth principle this morning. God's justice takes unexpected twists. Verse 17. Now Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite, for there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hatzor, and the house of Heber, the Kenite. Sisera arrives at the oak of Zaanim, north of Mount Tabor, hot, thirsty, exhausted. He still has a long way to go to get to Jabin at Hatzor. Heber, the Kenite, was a businessman who had lived at peace with Jabin, the king of Hatzor. As a businessman, he had tried to work out a sense of neutrality, and so he worked with the Canaanites and he prospered in the north. And Sisera then felt safe in his home. Jael, Heber's wife, goes out to meet Sisera. That's contrary, by the way, to all local customs. A woman would never go out to meet a man in the Arab or Israeli world in public. She invites him into her tent, the tent of the women. Again, contrary to all local customs. But he goes because what better place to hide and rest for a while? He asks for a drink. She gives him a drink of milk. The milk drink was probably a yogurt-type drink called leben or shensan by Arabs today. It's supposed to settle your stomach and help you rest. Well, it settled his stomach and helped him rest. It's not going to help his head too much in a moment. Sisera feels safe. He goes to sleep. It's been a long and rather surprising day, but it's about to get much worse for Sisera, because when he's asleep, Jael takes a tent peg and a hammer, drives the tent peg down through his head with so much force that it goes into the ground below his body. That's the power with which she drove that tent peg. Now, it's important to understand something else about the culture. Who did all the work in that culture with tents and setting up and taking down? I'll give you a hint, it wasn't the guys. It wasn't the men. Some ladies are sitting here saying, they still don't do the work. It was the women. It was the women who handled the hammers, not the men. So Jael was skilled at using a hammer and a tent peg. Those were her tools. She was far better at it than her husband. And God used the tools of a woman to defeat the most powerful warlord in that area. God used the brains of a woman named Deborah and the skills of Jael to win his battle. The abilities of the women are the means God uses for victory. And when Barak arrives, she can show him that the enemy is already dead and so fulfill Deborah's prophecy. God's justice takes unexpected twists. As I read the commentators on this passage, I was struck once again by how Christians are uncomfortable with these stories. Some writers openly say that this is not the New Testament Christian way at all. Jael used deception and murder to do the job, and that's not what the Bible teaches us to do. In fact, they basically say that Jael should have asked, what would Jesus do? And he would have led her to some different course of action at this point. Well, the problem is that the Bible is very pro-Jael. Over in chapter 5, which we'll look at next Sunday, she is applauded by God as a hero. It says God blessed her for what she did. And those who did not help her or did not do anything about this are cursed by God in chapter 5. So we can't say and get out of it by just saying, well, you know, she was a person who accomplished something for God, but she shouldn't have done it this way. It is clear that God approves. Now, how can that be? Well, first of all, I think the picture of Jael using deception and murder is probably incorrect. And I'm going to talk more about that next Sunday, because chapter 5 is sort of the explanation from God's perception of what is going on. So I guess you'll have to wait till next week for me to discuss more the ethical issues involved in this. And it also touches on some of the other judges as well. But for now, think of it this way. Instead of thinking about it as murder, think about it as an execution. Because that is essentially what it is here. It is God in His justice using Jael to execute an oppressor, a murderer, a rapist. Because that's what Sisera was, in fact. He was not an innocent man, as we will learn. And this is God's form of execution. You see, God cares about justice. God uses men and women willing to take a stand against injustice in this world and in our country to accomplish what He wants to get done, sometimes with surprising twists. The little Turkish monk Telemachus ran out onto the Colosseum floor at Rome. The crowd was filled with bloodlust as the gladiators fought that day, many never to rise again. In the name of Christ, stop, The little monk shouted. Again and again he screamed, "In the name of Christ, stop!" The crowd did stop momentarily, surprised by this interruption in their entertainment. Nearly 750,000 gladiators had died to serve their entertainment needs in Rome by that time. And now this little man, standing on the Colosseum floor, would dare to tell us to stop? The crowd stoned Telemachus to death on the floor of the Colosseum for interrupting their sport. But it was the last time the Colosseum was used for such entertainment. After Telemachus, the emperor banned the gory spectacle. God works through His people to stop the evil ways of men. What will God do in our day? How does God want to use you where you are? God saves in surprising ways, and He uses surprising people to do it. Philip Halley grew up in one of the toughest neighborhoods of Chicago during the Roaring Twenties. He lived in a building they named the Cockroach Building, and he saw the gangster John Dillinger shot and carted away on his very street when he was a little boy. As an adult, he became a philosopher and a scholar specializing in the evils of humanity. He wrote a book called The Paradox of Cruelty, which was highly acclaimed by the scholarly world. One day in 1974, he became so angry, however, that he could no longer live. He was filled with such anger that it turned to depression, and he feared for his own family members because of this anger. And so he had to get away from them by himself. And he realized that his studies, he was an expert in human cruelty, and all of his studies over the years in human cruelty had changed him. And he was becoming like those he studied. He was filled with a horrible anger against them and all others. He didn't like himself anymore. He reached for a book about the resistance movement in Germany during World War II because those stories always brought him some measure of comfort, and he started reading about a little town called Le Chambon. Despite all of his studies, he was not familiar with this story. It is the story of how a little town of French Huguenots, those are French Protestants, Christians, saved over 5,000 Jews during the reign of the Nazis, one by one, sheltering them, protecting them, and getting them out of the country. When he got to the bottom of the third page, he felt an itch on his cheek, and he reached up to scratch it, only to realize that his face was awash with tears. Tears came streaming down his cheeks. He went on to tell this little-known story of the resistance in a book called Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed, and he found healing for his own soul in the story of those Christians who did what they could in a world gone mad with evil. Several years later, Philip Halley was in Minneapolis lecturing on the subject when a woman with a French accent stood up in the back of the lecture hall and she said, "You have been speaking about the village that saved all three of my children." There was a moment of silence before the woman went on to thank him for telling this American audience the story of this special town filled with Christians. She said the Holocaust was storm, lightning, thunder, wind, rain, yes, and Le Chambon was the rainbow. Le Chambon, the Christians, were the rainbow. Philip Halley commented, "Everybody knew what the rainbow meant in the 9th chapter of the book of Genesis. Hope. Hope. We are the people of hope. Father, teach us. Teach us that we, as your instruments are the one hope for this world. For in you, people can find hope. And use us to deliver that hope, we pray. In Jesus' name, amen.